The following program from the North Carolina Reading Service, presented for our audience of blind and print-impaired listeners. And it's the Indie Week and IndieWeek.com, the online magazine, and it's read today by John Federson. Welcome, folks, to our one-hour show, which will become a podcast after our initial broadcast. The issue dated March the 30th of 2023. And we fade out our music and get going. We'll move to IndieWeek.com. As we often do, they have more up-to-date articles than the print edition. And the first one involves the veto that Governor Cooper has been overridden by both houses of the legislature. That's his gun law veto, trying to have the legislature trying to loosen restrictions on pistol purchases. And the State House and had voted Wednesday to override, and the Senate overridden on Tuesday. And all Republicans in favor, all Democrats opposed in the Senate. In the House, Republicans 71 voted, and 46, all those who voted to uphold. No votes were recorded for Representative Cecil Brockman, Tricia Cottom, or Michael Ray. With those absences, Republicans had the needed votes, 3/5 of majority of those present and voting, to override. And rather than stick to a specific topic, we'll just go as we see these articles and more. Another one now from IndieWeek.com, a dateline yesterday. Raleigh Council open to amending missing middle policy. That's the Raleigh City Council. They make changes to address residents' concerns. Their progressive missing middle housing policy looks like it's here to stay, following a conversation last week between longtime council members and newly elected representatives. Some voters were worried that the city council's four new members elected in November of last year would push to end missing middle. That's a set of policy changes that allow developers to build a greater variety of housing units, like duplexes, townhomes, and accessory dwelling units, ADUs, in traditional single-family neighborhoods. The policy was a focal issue during the last election and remains a major focus of today's debates over local politics. Many older, long-time homeowners adamantly oppose the policy, arguing it damages neighborhood character, has a negative impact on the environment, and doesn't actually guarantee the creation of more affordable housing. Other city residents argue the missing middle policy is long overdue update to Raleigh's exclusionary zoning practices, which help contribute to the current affordability crisis. Despite extreme arguments on both sides, the City Council seems poised to compromise on possible reforms to this missing middle policy. During a workshop last week, council members talked about addressing residents' concerns about affordable housing, community engagement, and the environment. Affordable housing. One common complaint about missing middle is it doesn't guarantee the construction of affordable homes. During a series of neighborhood meetings earlier this year, dozens of people brought up affordability as one of their top concerns about missing middle policy. One Raleigh resident, according to a report by city staff, said, "I'm in Boylan Heights, an older neighborhood that does have a lot of these missing middle types. The costs have gone up so much that my neighbors could not afford to buy now." Mayor Mary Ann Baldwin and other city council members have argued the policy itself will help create more affordable housing. Smaller homes, by their nature, are more affordable than large single-family homes in the same area. Older neighborhoods like Boylan Heights and Oakwood will continue to be expensive. But the policy also creates room for smaller homes in other parts of Raleigh, where property values are generally lower. Eric Braun, a former land use lawyer and 6-year member of the Raleigh Planning Commission, said that across the country, people using missing middle are simply trying to return development rules to what they were before World War II. Those neighborhoods had different types of housing and even small, small commercial uses. If the policy is allowed to really develop over time and be implemented fully, it allows people that have different income levels to move to more places across the city. When it comes to guaranteeing that new construction is affordable, the city council is limited in what it can legally do. Inclusionary zoning, a tool that mandates developers build affordable homes, is banned under state law. Last week, however, council members talked about possibly raising that issue with the state legislature, as well as exploring other strong tools they could use to incentivize affordable housing. Mayor Pro Tem Corey Branch said during the work session, "One of the ongoing themes is really affordability, regardless of the type. That's something we can look at. Look at the tools we have available currently, and if there's something else that may be out there. Have conversations with county, state, and federal government about options to incentivize affordability." Baldwin added that his council is working with Urban Lands Institute on a study that will help members learn what other cities are doing to incentivize affordable missing middle housing. New council members focused more strongly on affordable housing, suggesting the city council should be doing more. Jane Harrison said, "This is a continual need. As we accelerate redevelopment opportunities here, we have to think about displacement pressures. What are we already doing in terms of anti-displacement work? How do we also tie that back to this missing middle program so it's clear we're making these commensurate investments so we're not further pushing people from their neighborhoods?" Harrison suggested the city council consider developing an anti-displacement plan like the one created by the city of Portland, Oregon. She also asked about instituting new rules for the sizes of homes allowed to be built under the missing middle policy. Limiting square footage, she said, could contribute to affordability. Councilmember Megan Patton agreed, saying she wanted the city council to explore tweaking these missing middle rules on square footage and setbacks to, quote, get construction that will lend itself to affordable options. Councilmember Christina Jones said she wants to ensure the city council delivers on its promises to increase affordability, saying, "I don't want to say we're going to do this and then not have it in place so it's effective and really helping the people that need it." City staff are expected to give a report to the city council later this year on the number and types of homes that have been constructed under this missing middle policy. Then, community engagement. One of the biggest complaints about missing middle is it prevents residents from commenting on or managing new construction projects. Under the council's old rules, developers who planned to build townhomes or apartments in traditional single-family neighborhoods might have been required to notify nearby residents and hold community meetings to discuss their plans. In the age of community advisory councils, CAC, residents sometimes banded together to oppose such projects, forcing the developer to compromise on the construction design or recommending the city council deny the rezoning request. Under this missing middle policy, developers can now build many different types of housing by right without notifying residents or requesting a change to rules from the city council. This has angered longtime Raleigh residents who don't want developers building taller, denser buildings in their neighborhoods, especially ones that don't, quote, fit in with the existing aesthetic. One resident during a series of meetings, according to a report by city staff, quote, "The unified development ordinance can seem like a rubber stamp. Projects go through without any public comment. The surrounding community could provide valuable feedback." Another resident put it more bluntly. "The problem I have is that we no longer have any input. Council has given the role to the staff to decide." With missing middle back on the table, the city council could add notification or neighborhood meeting requirements to the policy, which might hamstring developers who want to take advantage of the now flexible zoning rules. On the issue of community engagement, Councilmember Jonathan Melton said he was happy to discuss possible changes to the missing middle policy, but had some concerns, saying, "If we require a neighborhood meeting with the understanding the intent of these text changes is to allow these developments by right, I'm worried people are going to come with the expectation there's going to be some sort of vote or impact on the process, and that's not going to be there. We have to be careful about that. We don't want to create more confusion." Moreover, he said, why should a neighborhood meeting be required for townhomes but not single-family homes if both are being built under the same zoning rules? Quote, "If someone can build a mansion next to my house and I have no say in it because it's their property and that's allowed by right, why do I have to weigh in if someone can build a duplex or a quad or some townhomes? What message are we sending about the types of people that live in big, single-family, expensive homes and the types of neighbors we welcome into multifamily living?" Councilmember Jones, also the former chair of the Raleigh CAC, was one of the biggest advocates for more community engagement when it comes to missing middle. During the community meetings the city held earlier this year, there were some very heated discussions between residents and city staff. Those show that people are frustrated with how missing middle was enacted, with very little community engagement. Jones said, "I understand it was COVID, but now the community is out here asking to be heard, and we have to do that. That just speaks to how much this community wants to be involved in the decision. The community engagement piece is critical. We can't do this without their voices. I'm really looking forward to seeing how we can reform." Other city council members, including Harrison and Mary Black, agreed community engagement was an important piece of missing middle. Although the city was able to get a more diverse population to participate in the missing middle meetings earlier this year, young people, renters, and people of color were still underrepresented. Pat Young, the city's director of planning and development, said, "I feel like we're on the right track. The social media engagement was much more than we've ever done, and using radio ads to reach the black community. It moved the needle. There was a lot more diversity at these meetings than in previous engagements. It still didn't reach the level of full representation, but it was a big improvement." Melton and Black each said they wanted to see more young people and renters participate in discussions. Black added that it was important for the city to continue to reach out to people of color and people across different income levels. He said, "As a young renter in the city, I think it's important for us to be activating our own political autonomy in talking about the city we want to create. What I hear when I talk to renters is they don't feel a part of this process. Things are changing and growing, but it's happening to them without their concerns being a part of it. We have opportunities now to be really thoughtful about engagement, especially with regards to renters, since we make up so much of the population." Overall, new council members seemed on board with the missing middle policy, though the council as a whole plans to continue discussing possible reforms. Harrison, in particular, wants to ensure trees continue to be protected, possibly through changes to the missing middle rules about setbacks and neighborhood transitions. The council is also still working on a new policy to enact tree protections for lots under 2 acres. Harrison and Patton each said the city should continue educating residents about how zoning rules have changed and give them an easy way to find out about the rules in their area. Both have heard from people in their districts who are confused about what is and isn't allowed under this missing middle policy. Ultimately, one of the strongest statements on missing middle came from Patton, who said she wanted to look at how and why missing middle allows large construction projects on small lots. This could lead to a discussion about reducing the overall density allowed by the policy. She said, there's a big spectrum here. Okay, a duplex can be built right beside me. That's a modest change. But there are ways people can assemble larger lots. Then, suddenly a community is looking at something like 16 townhomes being built on the acre of land next to them. That feels a little more impactful. I think we could use some analysis there. Patton's statement likely alluded to this controversial townhome project in Hayes Barton, where a developer plans to build 17 townhomes on about 2 acres. Nearby homeowners are suing Raleigh over the project in hopes of overturning missing middle entirely. So, whether the future of the policy will be determined by the city council or by a judge remains to be seen. Now a piece of statewide implications. North Carolina prosecutors want harsher punishments for drug dealers. Advocates say their proposal will cause more overdoses. As these drug overdoses and deaths increase in North Carolina, as they are in many parts of the country, a bill to strengthen penalties for illegal drug distribution is quickly moving through the state legislature. Senate Republicans introduced Senate Bill 189 in early March during a news conference where lawmakers were surrounded by law enforcement and family who have lost loved ones to drug overdose. North Carolina sheriffs and district attorneys say they need this bill to impose higher penalties and lengthier prison sentences on people who distribute fentanyl, that potent synthetic opioid that's been added to many street drugs in recent years. Incarceration, said bill sponsor, Senator Michael Lazara from Jacksonville, incarceration should also be used as a tool to help stop people from distributing, selling fentanyl and other drugs. And putting criminals who distribute it behind bars will help disrupt the supply of fentanyl and send a clear message that this kind of behavior will be unacceptable. The bill sailed through the Senate with unanimous support and is awaiting a committee hearing in the House of Representatives. But some substance use experts say this approach to a public health crisis will likely cost more lives. Jennifer Carroll, a substance use researcher and assistant professor of anthropology at NC State, this law feels like death by a thousand paper cuts because they're all minor changes, all of which are harmful, and none of which we have any reason to believe actually reduce the harms of the drug supply in our community. As the drug overdose epidemic has steadily worsened over the past decade, state lawmakers have tried several approaches in attempts to curb the problem, from legalizing syringe exchanges to funding addiction treatment to harsher penalties for drug distribution. And in 2019, lawmakers passed a death by distribution law that allows prosecutors to charge someone with second-degree murder if they sell drugs to someone who then dies of an overdose. Senate 189 would essentially strengthen the state's death by distribution law. Advocates for people who use drugs say these types of laws only disrupt the drug supply, which creates more potential for overdoses. Additionally, with second-degree murder charges on the line, advocates say people using drugs will be hesitant to call for emergency services if someone overdoses. A statement issued by the North Carolina Survivors Union, a community-led statewide harm reduction organization of people impacted by drug use, said, quote, funds desperately needed to bolster public health in vulnerable and often overlooked communities are instead funneled to outdated and fruitless tactics that do nothing to save lives. Harm reduction organizations aim to reduce the negative effects of drug use by providing sterile injection and drug use supplies, testing for hepatitis C and HIV, providing an opioid overdose reversal drug called naloxone, and other supplies and resources to people in active substance use. In his 36 years as a prosecutor, Ernie Lee said he's seen some of the same people cycle in and out of jails and prisons and continue to use drugs. Now he's seeing multiple generations of people in the same families using drugs and getting arrested. Lee is the district attorney for Sampson, Duplin, Jones, and Onslow counties, rural counties in eastern North Carolina with a few treatment options for mental health and substance use issues. Lee told NC Health News while at the state legislature supporting Senate 189, "There has to be punishment, but I also wish there could be more treatment while you're being punished, because otherwise it just becomes a revolving door. It becomes very expensive for the state of North Carolina. Also, it's just the right thing to do. These people have problems." Lee said people in his area of the state need to be able to get help locally instead of being forced by lack of options to travel hours away to the Triangle area. But Lee and many other prosecutors draw a firm distinction between people using and drug dealers. Lee said, "For those people out there selling, I have no sympathy for them because they're basically profiting off others' misery. I've not been hesitant about prosecuting an individual for second-degree murder where they caused the death of someone by selling drugs to them." Advocates for people who use drugs say the line between dealer and user isn't so clear to cut. Some people who use drugs will sell enough drugs to support their own habit or to supply just their friends or family members with drugs. People who use drugs are encouraged for safety reasons not to use drugs alone. So if someone has supplied drugs to someone they're using with, and that person overdoses, those folks are going to hesitate to call for help for fear of being charged with second-degree murder, advocates say. People are always encouraged to call for help in the event of an overdose. A 2015 update to the 2013 Good Samaritan Law provides limited immunity from certain drug possession charges if someone calls 911 during a medical emergency. Senate 189 sponsors say they still want people to call for help, and the bill would add possession of up to 1 gram of fentanyl to the Good Samaritan Law protections in North Carolina. But advocates have long said the state's Good Samaritan Law doesn't go far enough. There are questions as to whether the victim of the overdose or others at the scene of the overdose would receive the same legal protections from arrest or prosecution if someone called for help. Ainsley Bryce, executive director of Holler Harm Reduction in Madison County, said it's really hard for folks to want to put themselves at risk for any type of engagement with law enforcement. Bryce said that there were 17 overdoses reported to Holler Harm Reduction in the first 2 weeks of March. People at only two of those incidents called 911 for help because they didn't have naloxone available. She said that's 15 people who were just not willing to interact with law enforcement because they were afraid of arrest. These laws don't offer protections, and they're not even necessarily being followed by the letter. We still have those being arrested for paraphernalia that they should be covered under. So I can't imagine adding a law like this to the book, what that's going to look like for our folks. What the data shows. North Carolina's death by distribution law, which is the latest legislative proposal seeks to strengthen, was passed in 2019, went into effect in January 1, 2020. In 2019, law enforcement agencies and district attorneys said they needed the death by distribution laws to put dealers behind bars and curb drug overdoses in their community. Advocates, including Carroll, told lawmakers at the time that death by distribution would decrease 911 calls during an overdose and would lead to a more unstable illegal drug market and more fentanyl entering the drug supply. At the time, no one could have predicted a global pandemic, which substance use experts said, people on the ground said, also greatly disrupted the drug supply and increased overdoses. Whatever the combination of factors, fentanyl-involved overdose deaths have only climbed since 2019. The number of overdose deaths where fentanyl was detected more than doubled in 2019 from 1,490 to 3,062 in 2022. The State Department of Health and Human Services showed a decrease in reported law enforcement overdose reversals across the state since 2018. While not all counties have reported their law enforcement reversal data to the state, those that did showed a decrease over time. In fiscal year 2019-20, there were 10 death by distribution cases filed by district attorneys statewide, according to data collected by the NC Administrative Office of the Courts. That's 2019-20. In 2020-21, there were 35 instead of 10 by distribution, and 2021-22, there were 46 cases. A review of the data from this Office of the Courts shows that Harnett County prosecuted the most over that three-year span with 11 total cases. Harnett has seen a 142% increase in overdose deaths from 2018 to 2021. The latest available rate of overdose in Harnett was 52 per 100,000 people, while the statewide rate of overdose deaths, 38.5 per 100,000 people, 52 versus 39. District Attorney Lee told senators gathered in a committee in March about a case he prosecuted in 2016 after a woman in his county came to him and asked him to charge the person who sold the drugs that killed her loved one. North Carolina has had a form of second-degree murder charge on the books for drug distribution since the 1980s. Lee said, "I worked for the Onslow County Sheriff at that time, and we were able to bring charges against an individual after extensive investigation to prosecute that case, and he was convicted of second-degree murder. And so I'm very passionate about this. I have people calling me continuously, 'What can you do to help my son? What can you do to help my daughter? What can you do to help my family?'" North Carolina Sheriff's Association also released a statement supporting 189, saying it would protect law enforcement officers and the public. Rockingham County Sheriff Sam Page told one committee, "I thank the committee for standing up for supporting the families today and families across North Carolina who have lost family members to these overdoses and fentanyl poisoning." Carroll, along with researchers Brandon Morrissey and Talid Sabawi, surveyed North Carolina prosecutors to better understand their reasons for pursuing these death by distribution cases, also known as drug-induced homicides. NC Health News reviews their findings, which are in the peer review process. Two-thirds of survey respondents reported having charged someone with a drug-induced homicide in the past. The respondents indicated that two of the highest-rated reasons for bringing these distribution charges were justice for the deceased, and justice or closure will be obtained for the family of the deceased. Carroll added the respondents were less confident that death by distribution cases would stop overdoses. "We found that one point prosecutors really agree on is that these laws will bring some sort of closure to the family. That is not a valid use of prosecution." In Madison County, Bryce said she knows many local residents who have lost loved ones to overdose who don't want closure in this way. Bryce said, "Who's going to feel better that their son-in-law is suddenly arrested for murder after they've lost their daughter? I know a lot of folks locally who have lost someone to overdose, and I don't know anybody who's gunning for vengeance on the person who provided the drugs in the first place. That's not really a top priority. I think the top priority is ensuring that there's safety available if that person is looking for it." Advocates for people who use drugs want to see the same energy and money toward public health solutions that have been shown to reduce overdose deaths. A statement from the Urban Survivors Union said, "It's time for lawmakers to recognize the failings of the drug war and come to the realization that we cannot punish our way out of the overdose crisis. Instead, we must prioritize a community-informed, culturally competent, and evidence-based approach to finally address this public health crisis. That means investing in accessible, humane drug treatment, funding harm reduction strategies, and passing a stronger Good Samaritan law that aligns with the problems facing North Carolinians today. Other countries have dealt with drug overdose epidemics in the past and have taken seemingly radical but effective strategies to reduce deaths, get people into treatment, and weaken their illegal drug markets. Carroll said the United States has been using a criminal justice approach for decades, and it's not working. It was going to help. It would have helped by now, she said. They're basically positing a strategy for reducing overdose that is ignorant and wrong. It would really be great if the same energy went into things we actually know reduce deaths, we actually know keeps young people safe, and that we actually know brings people out of crisis if they are living with substance use disorder. Now I'm going to move us over to the paper issue of Independent, Indy. And this is the food and drink article, and yet it's not so much about restaurants, but it is definitely about restaurant reviews. Very telling article. It's the cover issue, I believe, of this issue. People watched the video in Texas, California, Alaska, and Illinois. They watched it on iPhones, Androids, tablets, and laptops. They watched it. A few seconds of content featuring vague criticism of the customer service at the Durham vegan restaurant Earth to Us, and scores felt compelled to do the same thing. Rush to the restaurant's social media profiles, type out profane comments, and hit send. Yanitsa Pubil, who opened Earth to Us on Guest Road in 2019 and has since launched a second location in Raleigh, I started getting all these notifications and my body became numb. I didn't know what to do. I didn't know what had happened. When she found the video that spurred the comments, she grew even more confused. The previous day, on March the 9th, a North Carolina-based content creator who goes by Mr. Chime Time had posted a review of Earth to Us on Instagram and TikTok. Chime Time did not respond to Indy's request for comment. In typical fashion, Chime Time, who has more than 1 million followers across these two platforms and uploads multiple restaurant reviews each day, recorded the review while sitting in his car and eating takeout. The video raked in several hundred thousand views. His feedback on the food was largely positive. The ingredients in the loaded nachos were fresh, he told viewers, and the impossible burger patacon was something he would get again. The vegan mac and cheese was too salty, but he enjoyed the creamy texture. In the last few seconds of this video, he delivered his rating. "I'm going to rate this restaurant at an 8.5 out of 10, he said. However, due to customer service, it goes from 8.5 down to 4. Even without context, the point reduction was enough to mobilize an army of trolls. And on March 11th, when Chime Time posted a second review focused entirely on customer service, that army swelled. In the second video, which has nearly 1 million views on Instagram and TikTok, Chime Time names, mimics, and shows footage of an Earth to Us employee, we'll call him Omar, who Chime Time says made minimal eye contact, shrugged in response to questions about the menu, and walked away when Chime Time came up to order more food. This behavior, according to Chime Time, is that of an arrogant, condescending, disrespectful, rude individual. If you have a problem with face-to-face customer service, let me help you out. Let me tell you a little secret. Find another job. Work from home, bitch. In the hours after the video was posted, Pubil, the owner, says vitriolic comments on the restaurant's Instagram page rose to the mid-hundreds. Dozens of one-star reviews were posted on Google and Yelp. Many reviewers identified Omar by name and wrote from the perspective of real customers, parroting Chime Time's talking points. One Google reviewer wrote, "The food is decent, but the customer service was absolutely horrible. I have no idea how this guy sleeps at night. He lacks the respect that my 5-year-old has." Another wrote, in all caps, If you hate people, then work at home. You obviously don't understand customer service. People pay your bills. Horrible customer service will be your downfall. On Instagram, the comments, which Poobel has since disabled, were shorter and cruder. Fix your ass, shit ass attitudes. Fire that zesty worker. Poobel says it's like they don't understand that there's a human being on the other side who's receiving this. The scariest message were the private ones. Poobel says people were calling and saying something could happen to you after work when you close. She contacted the police and requested that they start checking in on the restaurant every few hours. If everything's okay, Poobel gives them a thumbs up through the window. But even with this precaution, Omar didn't feel safe enough to continue working at Earth to Us, says Poobel. Shortly after the videos were posted, he parted ways with the restaurant. Poobel says Omar is a member of the LGBT community. We were receiving phone calls saying, you have to get rid of that slur, or we'll come down there. He just felt too threatened. In the weeks since Chime Time uploaded his Earth to Us review, several users have dubbed him Keith Lee's alter ego. That's a reference to the wildly successful social media influencer who popularized the restaurant review format now used by many video creators. In most reviews, Lee focuses solely on flavor and only discusses customer service if he's had an especially positive experience with an employee. His reviews are forthright, but never scathing. When he doesn't like a dish, he always acknowledges that the taste is subjective, and he reserves his harshest criticism for corporate chains. Lee's platform has grown so large that his videos are now guaranteed to have a significant impact on the restaurants he reviews. In January, he posted a glowing review of Frankenson's, a pizza restaurant in Las Vegas that suffered heavy financial losses during the pandemic. Before the review came out, Frankenson's was preparing to shut its doors. After Lee's endorsement to his nearly 12 million followers, traffic increased so rapidly that the restaurant hired 23 new employees within 6 weeks. But overnight internet fame of this sort comes with its own challenges. In an era of staff shortage and waning tolerance for wait times, the immediate demand can be hard for restaurants to meet, especially if their phone lines are swamped with people who want to congratulate them from 3,000 miles away. Virality is virality. Whether a review is good or bad, a mob will descend. Restaurant reviews, of course, have existed for centuries. Like any form of criticism, they come with an implied directive for customers to support or not support a given subject. But when reviews are presented in a TikTok or Instagram format, the response to that directive intensifies. Unlike the local print publications where restaurant criticism originated, social media is geographically unbound and promotes immediate engagement. Users without a real stake are incentivized to weigh in, and mob mentality decimates nuance. For North Carolina viewers, Chime Time's videos might prompt a more traditional response. Visit the restaurants he endorses. Avoid the ones he doesn't. But for the hundreds and thousands of viewers who live elsewhere, passive abstention seems to feel less satisfying than, say, visiting a restaurant's Instagram page and commenting, "Came here all the way from Texas to tell you that you suck," with two crying emojis. To his credit, Chime Time seems to be somewhat cognizant of the responsibilities of a large platform. The vast majority of his reviews are positive. In his second Earth to Us video, he disclosed that he recorded the reviews in early February and spent a month trying to decide whether to post them. That's how much he hates posting negative reviews, he said. But something pushed him to take his gripes to social media. Chime Time had looked at the restaurant's Yelp and Google review pages, he said, and noticed that some previous patrons had experienced customer service issues as well. When he states this in the video, a patchwork of past reviews momentarily appears on the screen. He told the camera, the owner has failed to rectify this lingering situation. He also took issue with the fact that Poobel had pushed back on a number of one-star reviews. 2 years ago, for instance, when one reviewer wrote, I was told I couldn't have a plate. Poobel replied, you did not ask for plates. Like most restaurants, Earth to Us has received a number of customer service complaints on its review pages. Some align with Chime Times. Some were posted by self-identified anti-maskers. But many were left by people who never set foot in the restaurant, according to Poobel. And she's not even talking about the recent barrage. Last year, a customer came to Earth to Us with her children and a bag of non-vegan food from home, Poobel says. When the children started to eat dairy products, Poobel told the customers she could not allow non-vegan food on the premises. She tells the Indy she was very offended. She took to the internet and we got a whole bunch of one-star reviews from that. A lot of the reviews that Chimetime put in his video as justification for posting his own, they came from that. Review sites and their self-perpetuating cycles of contempt. How long until someone cites the latest fake slate of one-star reviews induced by Chimetime for the same purpose? If Poobel asserts herself in the replies, will people say she's out of line? Restaurant owners cannot opt out of Yelp or Google reviews, and removing reviews from bad actors is nearly impossible. In efforts to, quote, manage social activism review storms, though, Yelp recently implemented a feature called an unusual activity alert that temporarily blocks new reviews in response to signs of media-fueled activity on a business page. The alert had been activated on Earth to Us page since March 12th, one day after Chimetime's second video. 8 one-star trolls slipped in before that gate closed. For Yelp, a billion-dollar enterprise with a reputation for allegedly extorting advertising money from small business owners, the alert looks to be a step in the right direction, but that also comes with collateral damage. The morning of March 12th, a user on Durham's subreddit called on area Earth to Us regulars to leave positive reviews for the restaurant in an effort to counteract the trolls, writing, a small business is being put in jeopardy by people who have never visited. A few hours later, Yelp activated the alert, locking out both hate and love in one fell swoop. Poobel says she hopes the review block might compel more people to raise their issues with the business in person. If you have a meal, she says, and something is wrong or not to your liking, please tell us and we'll fix it on the spot. People are taking to the internet without talking to us. For those facing a torrent of online hate, the impulse is often to go forth into cyberspace and confront the trolls in their own arena. Poobel, as evidenced by some of her years-old responses on review platforms, has gone down this road before. This time, though, she took a different approach. She reached out to Chimetime and asked him to meet her in person, a grounded, sincere request that, in a way, invoked her restaurant's name. And on March 14th, Chimetime met Poobel at Earth to Us. Poobel says the conversation went well. She says he was speaking from the heart. He said, I truly apologize. I did not mean to cause any harm to your business. She told him about the threats her restaurant had received and reminded him the hospitality industry is still struggling from pandemic setbacks. The next day, Chimetime posted a third video about this restaurant. He apologized to Omar, the restaurant cashier, whose name he omitted this time, and implored his viewers to stop the threats and offensive comments. He did not, however, take down the offending viral video, which continues to garner hundreds of daily views and spark one-star reviews. The third video received significantly fewer views than the first two. That's a testament to the way social media algorithms favor strife over reconciliation. But Poobel says the backlash has subsided regardless. And though the Reddit user's Positive YELF campaign was stymied, people are still finding ways to show their support. Many are showing up in person. Poobo says, there was a woman who came in and said, I drove an hour and a half to come and get food from you because we love your food. I couldn't help myself because I could see the sadness on her face. I said, did you see the review? She said, yes, and I'm here to support you. Poobo says, haters are going to be haters, but the people that love you carry a greater weight. Jacqueline Cole now from Durham with another slightly unusual article about Durham's dog court. On December 2nd, 2021, Jasmine Bunch had a small birthday celebration for Stormy, her Maltese Yorkie mix. The dog wore a pink party hat and got a dog-friendly cake. A few hours later, Bunch took Stormy to a dog park where she got loose and encountered a gray pit bull named Savvy Blue that attacked her. Bunch rushed her dog to the vet, but it was too late. Stormy had died. A day later, the Animal Service Division of the Durham County Sheriff's dispatched Deputy Ashley Coward to investigate. She collected photos, medical reports, vaccination records, and witness statements to determine the level of risk posed by the dog. The conclusion? Savvy Blue was, quote, potentially dangerous. This is Durham County's process for dogs that are found to pose a risk to other animals or people. After an investigation, a dog is deemed by a sheriff's deputy to be dangerous if it has killed or severely injured a human, or potentially dangerous if it has killed or severely injured a domestic animal. The dog is then subject to restrictions that include muzzling in public and requiring the owner to post a warning sign outside the residence. The dog must also have a microchip implanted so it can be tracked. Sometimes the dog's owner challenges the determination that their dog is dangerous or potentially dangerous, which prompts the involvement of the Dangerous Dog Appeal Board. The 5-member board is responsible for hearing the appeals of owners who have had their dogs declared dangerous or potentially dangerous. Of these 5 members, 1 must be in the veterinary business, and no more than 2 can be employees of the government. The board is supposed to meet within 30 days of an appeal, although the schedule seems to have frequent delays. The 5 board members sit before the owner of the dog in question on Microsoft Teams. That's a video platform similar to Zoom. The dog owner appealing the decision presents evidence explaining why the decision should be overturned, and the sheriff's deputy presents the evidence that led to the initial accusation. Think of it as a dog court. After roughly an hour of discussion, a conclusion is made. Does this dog pose a threat? That decision is complicated, a process that involves a thick packet of witness statements, photographs, and evidence. To understand the work of the board, the Ninth Street Journal examined 6 recent cases from 2021 and 22. They involved dog-on-dog, or in one case, dog-on-chicken attacks. Like some other citizens' boards we've examined in our Under the Radar series, Dog Court is not very transparent. Its website offers an outdated contact and such sketchy details, we had to file public records requests to obtain information about recent cases. The former director for Durham County General Services, who is one of the senior members of the board, Motirio Kiamboiroyo, said the group gets from 4 to 6 appeals per year. She said their approach is to engage the community on both sides of the fence. But a review of recent cases show the process can also leave bitter feelings. Owners of some of the attack victims said watching the board overturn the designation of potentially dangerous can be a cold and insensitive process. In the case of Savvy Blue, her owner, Nicole Hope, argued her dog did not instigate the encounter and therefore did not deserve to be deemed potentially dangerous. In her written statement, she recalled Stormy got through the gate and ran toward us. But when Bunch described, she claimed Savvy Blue was barking and pulling at the leash, which caused her dog Stormy to bark back and slip through the fence toward Hope's two dogs, as if playing with and greeting them. Some facts were indisputable, though. Ultimately, Savvy Blue caused severe wounds that killed Stormy. Bunch, who had endured the death of her dog, had arrived at a virtual meeting on December 22nd that was immediately canceled because the case officer for the incident was not available that day. The video recording of this meeting shows Willie Darby, an attorney for the county and member of the board at the time, behaving jovially through the serious proceedings. At one point, he asked if they were, quote, in the midst of a superstar, referring to Hope, the owner of the dog who killed Stormy because Hope played basketball for NC Central. Darby shouted, my alma mater, as other members of the board whooped and laughed. One board member put two thumbs up toward her camera and smiled. Bunch is still miffed about that. It's not just an animal. That was my dog, and nobody's taking it seriously, said Bunch, who's a 24-year-old video editor at Warner Brothers Discovery, growing emotional on the phone. She said she felt the board was biased. There was essentially nobody on my side rooting for me. Also frustrating, the hearing was postponed twice without formal explanation and without a new date in sight. I have to take off work for this. Eventually, the postponements became too much for her. I was traumatized enough. I didn't even care to know what was next. She alerted the board she didn't want to attend any further meetings and was later informed of the verdict via email. They had overturned the determination that Savvy Blue was potentially dangerous. Mimi Davis, a Duke Research administrator and member of the board, acknowledged that Darby's comment was strange. In response to Bunch's complaints, Davis said it was an awkward moment, simply because the person whose dog was injured, killed, expressed that she didn't like the interaction. Davis said the tone of each meeting literally depends on the people involved, and each process is case by case. Despite this explanation, Bunch remains disgruntled. Another dog owner, Nancy Gray Terry, said the board was disorganized when it considered the case of Buddy, her mini dachshund poodle mix that was injured by Bella, a boxer mix. The attack occurred when Buddy was being walked by Pratijpaj Kapnava Krishnaka Babu, a postdoctoral researcher at Duke, in January of 2022. Krishnaka Babu was neighbors with Gray Terry. She remembers him being afraid of many dogs, but my little guy decides to befriend him, she said, referring to the special bond he shared with Buddy. One day, Krishnaka Babu was walking Buddy down Orient Street when a dog slowly approached him from a nearby house and became violent. Before I could lift Buddy completely in my hand, it had grabbed his belly, Krishnaka Babu wrote in his statement to the board. The attack caused serious damage to Buddy's abdomen and led to major surgery. It was so expensive that Gray Terry set up a GoFundMe page. Although Buddy survived the attack and surgery, he died a few months later from cancer, which Gray Terry suspects spread as a result of the attack. A sheriff's deputy investigated and determined that Bella was potentially dangerous. In a letter addressed to Ashley Carr, who was listed as Bella's owner, the office of the sheriff wrote, Our investigation has shown sufficient evidence to prove the dog described above while being off your property attacked and injured Buddy. Carr appealed on a technicality, saying she did not live at that address. When Gray Terry arrived at her virtual hearing, the woman representing the accused dog denied that the dog was hers. This led to confusion. Gray Terry said it was kind of like the homework had not been done. When the committee realized that Carr, the supposed owner, was not in attendance, a woman named Christine Miller unmuted herself and explained that Bella was Carr's dog, but had been in Miller's possession due to Carr's inability to care for Bella. Darby felt comfortable proceeding. Someone is claiming ownership, so let's go with the hearing and see where we end up, he said, according to a recording of that meeting. The board and Sheriff's Deputy Wendy Pinner, the investigator on that case, then had opportunity to ask questions of both dog owners. After roughly an hour of questioning and evidence, it was time for closing statements. Miller went first. "I have no argument," she said. "I'm devastated at what happened to their dog, but other than that, I have no argument. I rest, or whatever. Thank you." She was crying, her camera held close to her face, showing her teary eyes, blue hair, and the moving scenery behind her as she was in the passenger seat of a car. The board then went into a separate private meeting to deliberate and decide the case. When they returned to the public Microsoft Teams room, the witnesses and dog owners had left. The board had forgotten to ask them to stay. The board upheld the deputy's decision that Bella was potentially dangerous. Now, months later, Krishnappa Babu and Gray Terry said they were not satisfied with the process. It was disorganized, they said, and they weren't convinced it made a difference. When Krishnappa Babu walked by the house where Buddy was attacked, he didn't see a required warning sign. Gray Terry reflects on her experience with the Dangerous Dog Appeals Board as kind of like a waste of time. When asked about these criticisms, the county attorney, Alan Andrews, told Ninth Street Journey, quote, "I will do all within my power to ensure these proceedings are conducted with decorum and due regard for the seriousness of the matters at hand." All right, Indie Week has come up against the clock for this issue, and I only will have time to simply read the names of a few of the articles that I was unable to get to. One, a nonfiction book at Algonquin Book, Daniel Wallace. "This Isn't Going to End Well, the True Story of a Man I Thought I Knew." And this man is local, Mr. Wallace. He used to frequent with a friend, William Neely, and the book is about this friendship. The next one is On Screen, a film that opens tomorrow, Friday, March 31st, Dungeons and Dragons, Honor Among Thieves. Glenn McDonald gives it 4 stars. And music, Mighty Poplar transforms American standards in a new release called Mighty Poplar. And on stage, Egg Nymph takes on The Aliens, Annie Baker's Tale of the Generational Discontent. And that's, again, Friday and Saturday this week. And, again, I'm sorry that we have to close.